Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Our guest today is Billy Livingston, an award-winning author of several novels, who also writes short stories, poetry, and sometimes dabbles in essays. Her books include The Chick at the Back of the Church, The Trouble with Marlene, a book that was produced as a feature film called Sitting on the Edge of Marlene, Going Down Swinging, Cease to Blush, Greedy Little Lies, One Good Hustle, and most recently, The Crooked Heart of Mercy, which we'll be dipping into a bit today. She has also penned shorter works that can be found in such outlets as the National Post, Poetry Ireland Review, Toronto Life, and the Windsor Review, among many, many other places. We will link you to Miss Livingston's personal webpage on our website, where you can find many of these works. And not just a prolific author who has appeared on many best book lists, Billy has also found time to serve humanity as a file clerk, cocktail waitress, model, actress, milk cooler filler, a booth host at a plumbing convention, and a chocolate sampler. I guess chocolate has to be sampled, and Billy was the right person for the job, apparently. Ms. Livingston was referred to me by a former guest of one of our previous shows, Tim Keller, who happens to be her husband, and they both live here in Vancouver, Canada, just north of our Research on Religion studios up here in the Puget Sound region. Billy, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hey, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is going to be fun because I always like to try something new and dip my toes into new waters here on the podcast. And though I have to admit, I feel like I'm wading into water way above my head here because I am not a big consumer of fictional writing or poetry. Now, we have had a few guests talk about fiction before, such as our episodes on Charles Dickens and J.R.R. Tolkien and Dante, but those shows were about other people examining the thought and social impact of authors who had long passed on. Rarely do we get a live and in-person fictional author here to talk to, so this should be fun for me. I just got to check. You are a living author, correct?
Let me check. Yes, we've got a pulse.
Got a pulse. Okay, that's always good for my guest here. So what we want to do today is explore some of the religious themes in your work, most notably the recent book, The Crooked Heart of Mercy. But I first want to start with some more general info on you and your background, because I'm always fascinated on where ideas come from, and they come from some of the most unusual places sometimes. So here's my question for you. How does one go from filling milk coolers to becoming a widely recognized author?
That was my first job, filling milk coolers at a convenience store when I was about 12 years old. And I went on to do lots of other odd jobs. I think I just did nothing but odd jobs, including modeling. It kind of landed in my lap just before I graduated high school. My mother, who was a pretty severe alcoholic, she started into AA, and she met a woman who worked with a modeling agency, and so I kind of fell into it that way and left high school and went straight to Japan and did that kind of stuff for a while. And then I came home and kind of went between modeling and acting, and I worked for a company that did promotional stuff, so I did conventions, and I even did a job for Garfield Kitty Litter. Mm. I was Garfield.
Really? The one of those big animals?
Yeah, with the giant head.
Yeah, oh, wow.
giant cat head. And all the suits came out of their meeting, and I was there waiting so that they could have their picture taken with me. And every once in a while, I get a little squeeze from someone saying, "Are you a boy kitty or a girl kitty?"
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I could do a whole, like, hour long of talking to people in those animal costumes, because I'm sure the folks, too, at Disney have just the strangest stories.
I know.
But, yeah, Aja, what about this chocolate sampling job? That one, you put that on your website, and I mean, that must be something that was one of the coolest jobs ever to have.
Oh, well, it sounds better than it was. I didn't actually sample the chocolates myself, but I gave them out to people. I gave the samples out.
Oh.
That was part of this job with this promotional company. So you'd stand in, you know, the kind of the food, the gourmet food area of a department store and hand out, you know, truffles or hand out some fabulously expensive jam on a cracker.
Mm-hmm.
And people will just line up because it's free.
Yeah, no doubt. I saw that on your website as chocolate sampler. The thing that immediately popped in my mind was that I Love Lucy episode where the chocolates are coming through, and he's like, "Got to try every one to make sure it's good." You know, so this is really interesting, right? You've had all these different odd jobs, you know, going to Japan and modeling and coming back and being Garfield. Yeah. How do you end up being an author?
Well, you know, there was a lot of traveling with modeling, and I did a lot of writing just to try to keep my sanity, because it's not a really sane occupation. You're mostly obsessing over your weight all the time and concerning yourself with your exterior and what other people think of your exterior. And, you know, I think because I was young and I was kind of afraid of institutions, and I didn't want to go to, I was afraid of going to post-secondary school, I was afraid of going to university, so when modeling fell in my lap, I just did it, and it was easy, but the flip side of that is the kind of emotional side of it, where you just feel like you are slowly losing yourself, and when you write, it somehow helped me feel like I was keeping a grip on who I was and where I had come from. And so I started writing a lot of, I didn't even know what it was, but it, you know, became poetry eventually. And that was The Chick at the Back of the Church, the name of the book. And that title had come about because while my mother and my home life was really a mess, and I had been in and out of foster homes, I was kind of adopted by a couple of friends who were evangelicals and went to a church that wasn't too far away from where I lived. And as an evangelical yourself, you know what a second family it can be. So it did become a second family for me, even though at the time I had, you know, some problems with notions of the divine, and I think I was kind of an agnostic at best.
And this
those
is...
things all wove together and took up a big part of my writing.
Mm-hmm.
Of struggling with those questions of family and faith and.
Yeah,
I
wanted to ask about that. We're going to dip into the faith angle a little bit more, but given your trajectory, you have all these odd jobs. A lot of what you're writing now must be coming from those experiences, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about not having any post-secondary and not being an academic is, though, you know, my personal education certainly has gaps in it because I'm self-taught, the flip side of it is you are all the time working and out in the world, not in the ivory tower. You are out in the world and working with people who, you know, are in the, for lack of a better descriptor, in the working class. And so you're constantly meeting people and listening to people and navigating people, which is great for a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, academic writing, you know, it's not all it's cracked up to, because it's kind of boring, right? We just are looking at statistical charts and things, but you get to live some of this stuff and really hear stories from people And
and I think that's the best way to get to understand a community is to be among people. You know, you frequently academic writers that I know, even fiction writers, they often will choose to read a book on a subject rather than going and being there with the people who, either the people who do that for a living or, you know, a particular faith, the most recent book, there are spiritualists in it, as in people who speak to the dead or believe they speak to the dead. And I had a writer offer me a book that I could read and sit down and read all about, kind of fortune-telling and spiritualists. And I thought, why do that when I could go to the United Church of Spiritualism and be there with people and listen to what they say?
And it's probably neat. You get a vantage point that I don't think a lot of scholars do. So scholars, you know, the academic scholars like to do this. They do their field work. But, you know, you can tell an academic coming from 10 miles away. And when they plop themselves down in a community to observe them, and people are probably looking at them saying, okay, this is a scholar. I got to behave this way. But here you are just working side by side these people. And like I sit in the tavern every Thursday and I got all my friends. They don't even know what I do. And the stories just come. They don't, that's the kind of stuff that's just absolutely fascinating from people.
Well, yeah, because mostly people just want to be heard. They want to be listened to. And if they feel that you are interested in hearing them, they will often spill their guts in a way that they wouldn't if they felt that you were examining them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And so that's what we're trying to do here. So let me ask you a little bit about your religious background. You already touched upon it. Foster home in an evangelical community. You had some agnostic beliefs. Tell us about your spiritual journey.
Well, as I mentioned to you before, I grew up Orthodox heathen. My mother she had converted to Catholicism when she married her first husband, but she really didn't want much to do with the church, and she couldn't stand anything in the realm of people who were self-described born-again Christians. That just drove around the bend. And so when I started going to this evangelical church, it really bothered her. She said, "Why can't you just become a Catholic like a normal person?" And because she likes the idea of a very organized box, and to her, Catholicism at least fit that bill. So I was in that church for probably up until I was about 16. And right around that time, I left home. I ran away, if you will, because my mother had started drinking again and was very suicidal. And she talked a lot about killing herself. And I had come to the point in my feeling with her that I was ready to help her. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, this is perverse. I'm thinking about helping my mother kill herself. And I finally mustered up the guts to say, if this is something you want to do, if you feel like you can't face another day, then I'm going to leave you to it, but I'm not going to watch. And so I left home. And there was a bit of, I don't know, for lack of a better term, kind of judgment coming from the kids that I was in church with, and they were troubled by the language I used and by the background that I came from. It was not a sparkly, clean environment, that's for sure. And so I left the church, I left my mother, kind of left all of that, and in the meantime, she got sober, and I eventually came back. And in the coming years, I just developed more and more and deeper a fascination with religion in a very broad sense and faith in a very broad sense. And I started calling myself a church hopper. And so probably more accurate would be a house of worship hopper, because over the years, I just went everywhere. I went to... I went to evangelical churches, I went to Anglicans, Catholic churches, Orthodox churches, I went to synagogues, I even went to a Raelian meeting. I don't know if you're familiar with Raelians.
Yeah, that's they're kind of like outer space things, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
believe that humanity came from aliens seeding the planet with DNA. So they're their own fascinating crop of people, but it interests me to be in a room where people are searching.
Yeah. And again, you know, you can tell this from your work background, but you know, you get to dabble in all these different areas and really see, and you're not only a participant, but you're an observer in terms of all this. Now, your husband, Tim, is a pretty devout Catholic, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So are you doing the Catholic thing now?
Well, when we got married, I was baptized Eastern Catholic, Ukrainian Catholic. And so I do go, but I kind of consider myself an ecumenical sort. I guess Catholic in the true sense of the word, which is universal. And so I do like being in, you know, different places and speaking to different people. I really love hearing preaching and homilies and, you know, all of that in a variety of different places. I love listening to all of that, all of the different theologies that people bring to the pulpit and to the pew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this puts you in a really unique position that not many people experience. You're going from Eastern Catholic churches to evangelical born again to Raelian and hearing all this stuff. And I mean, if you think about it a little bit, are there any themes or unifying patterns that you see between all of these sermons, or is it just a panoply of confusing mishmash?
Well, you know, of course, that can be there, and there are times when you go into a church where you feel like that. This is just a mashup. There's nobody at the helm here, but. Generally, what I see is a search for meaning and a yearning for goodness and truth, and people that are searching for what is beyond the self and the meat of this world. And I think the people that regularly go to church or go to synagogue, I think they are exercising a kind of basic trust in the divine. And that I see, you know, throughout. I've been to a couple of Buddhist temples, and I certainly see it there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other observation that you made that I have to bring up before we dive into your own work is too that when you were at the evangelical church, you weren't people didn't see you as coming from the sparkly clean family, and mm-hmm. that's one of the things that kind of drives me up the wall about some of the. Strong churchy types is that everybody's led a pretty septic or antiseptic, I should say, lifestyle. And,
right.
And you know, your religion is, as you say, it's about searching and searching through some of the troubles of life. And without some of those rough spots, I just wonder if that search is a little bit different in that regard.
Yeah, it becomes very narrow, and I think a lot of that can be really driven by ego and fear. I do remember a youth pastor at the church where I went as a teenager, and him telling our youth group that none of us should be spending any time, if they hear of couples that have moved in together who aren't married, we shouldn't be spending any time with them. We should basically cut them out of our lives. And I thought, that doesn't sound very Christian.
Yeah, no, you're supposed to be doing
like something Jesus would do.
Yeah. Yeah, you're supposed to be doing the proselytizing and getting to these folks. You don't write them off and push them off the cliff. We've had the same thing go through one of our churches with you're not supposed to spend any time in taverns and reading the Bible in a tavern. And it's like, well, why not? let's go ahead and dig into some of your writings now. And you mentioned your first book, which is actually an anthology of a number of your poems that date back back into the 1990s, I think. It's, and the book is called The Chick in the Back of the Church. And at first, when I saw that on your website, I go, ooh, that's a saucy novel. But it's poems, right? And it has this religious theme because it's got church in there. So what is going on with there? Why did these things become a thematic book of these poems?
Well, they aren't. They don't all, weave into a religious theme. But the title poem actually came from when I was young and I was in that church. There was a girl who was adopted, and her father was kind of an odd duck, and he used to sometimes turn around in the middle of a church service and stare at the girls, at the young girls. And a lot of us got the willies from him. And he seemed to be most fascinated with the girls that may have seemed the wildest to him. And so that poem was kind of playing with that. Generally, the poems in there are kind of, you know, they deal with a lot of addiction, and they deal with love and family and, you know, pardon the cliche, but the ties that bind, you know, and searching for love in the midst of really dark situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to explore that a little bit more, too, because when people start to think about, you know, Christian writing and religious themes, they can almost always fall back to the Hallmark Channel, right, where you have, mm-hmm. you know, the biggest trouble is somebody accidentally painted the fence the wrong color, and what's dad going to do? And, you know, it's those kind of things that, you know, are great for seven-year-olds and stuff, but, you know, it's not the stuff of really life. So the stuff that you're writing is a lot grittier, and it comes from your personal experience. And so when you're writing these things back in the 90s, you mentioned that, you know, you were doing modeling, and so you just start writing this stuff. And did you have a sense of, I'm going to write this for a specific audience, I hope it gets published, or was this more therapeutic and it just kind of came to be that they were published?
It really just came out, and I didn't think that I could be published, because I really thought that the people who had published books were people who went to Harvard and Yale. Mm-hmm. I really thought it was people who had PhDs. And, I felt like we kind of came from the wrong side of the tracks, and the likelihood of me entering that world was about nil. But my mother, by this point, she was sober and was off everything, all the pills, not drinking, and she had started designing greeting cards, and she got a book that was called Poets Market that she thought was going to help her sell these greeting cards that she'd made, but they were all markets for poets, and she gave it to me, and so it was fascinating to me that you could, you know, here were directions, a how-to of sending your work out to magazines all over the world. And so I started submitting poetry to magazines, and those are the first publications that I had.
And I just have to ask this, what was it like getting the first acceptance letter saying, yep, we're going to publish your work? You remember that at all?
So, yes, I was so excited. I mean, there was no payment. I was going to get two copies.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that somebody thought that what I had written was worth, you know, worth the ink and the paper and the the cost of printing.
Yeah. I have to say that because my first academic publication, again, a lot more, it's a lot more dry, but, you know, you get it and you're like, whoa, I can actually do this. And it is that kind of thing. Like, somebody's sending me a free copy, I was going to go out and buy 10. So, yeah. No, I think that's pretty cool. So you're doing this poetry, and the next step that you take is to write a novel. And this was your publication, I think it was in the year 2000 or so, in a book called Going Down Swinging. Tell us a little bit about that book and how you made the transition from poetry or short story writing to coming up with a novel, and what is this book all about, and how do religious themes work into it?
Okay. Well, I felt a lot of the poems in The Chick at the Back of the Church became the foundation for Going Down Swinging. And so this is a, I would call it loosely autobiographical fiction. It's certainly not a memoir. It wouldn't hold up in court. It's very fictionalized. But it's about an 8-year-old girl and her 40-some mother who's a severe alcoholic. And so it's loosely based on my mother and me. And so it goes back and forth between this child's voice and her mother's voice. The child is eventually taken away by social services and put in a foster home with Jehovah's Witnesses. So that was probably my first immersion into a faith and somebody else's faith and somebody's faith who, in that household, the things that they believed and adhered to were completely foreign to me. I think they meant well all the way around, but it was a difficult house to be in, to kind of go from being taken away from your mother and not know where you're going to landing in a family where they are really crossing their fingers for the end of the world to come. And not to say that this is the case for all Jehovah's Witnesses, but this was certainly the case within this family. And, the kids talked about when there would be a new heaven and a new earth, and they talked about the lion, how the lion would lie down with the lamb, and they planned on what animals they were going to get after Armageddon. One of the girls was going to get a bear. One of them was going to get a lion. And so that was kind of, the way these kids thought, and it was so foreign to me. And all I could think to ask them was, well, is there going to be TV in heaven? I couldn't imagine what else will we do.
Yeah.
I don't really want a bear. So, as I got older and started writing, you start, as an adult, trying to process these experiences and these feelings through an adult lens. And if you're writing a child, which I was for half of the book, then you've got to kind of fall back down that rabbit hole and see it with the same eyes that you did at the time.
Mm-hmm. And how were you...
So that's what that book's about.
Yeah, how were you exploring religious themes in this? Or was it really a religious book? Did you want to say religious things, or was just religion the background radiation to this whole story?
Religion was a background radiation, but I wouldn't consider it a religious book at all.
Yeah.
I wouldn't consider really any of my books to be religious, per se.
Yeah.
And there's this great... did you ever read Mystery and Manners, Flannery O'Connor?
No. Like I said, the last, I think, fiction book I read was back
no,
in
it's
college.
No, it's not. It's a collection of essays.
Oh. That one, too.
He was out in the world speaking and alive in the world.
Yeah.
And so she talked about Christian novelists, and it reminded her of the story of the legend of St. Francis and the Wolf of Gubbio, and the legend was that St. Francis of Assisi had converted this wolf. And she said that, I don't know that he actually, whether he converted the wolf or the wolf's character didn't just greatly improve after he met St. Francis. But the moral of the story is that the wolf, in spite of his improved character, always remained a wolf. And so it ought to be with the Christianized novelist. So, your primary job is to tell a story. And, if matters of faith are there, then they should really kind of weave in with the story. Otherwise, it becomes... akin to, that Wolf of Gubbio walking on his hind legs. It's not it's not a story anymore. It's just passing on platitudes and information.
Yeah, and this, I wanted to talk a little bit about this. We'll also touch on this a little bit at the end with some of your reflections on your own career. But when you talk about this, the Christian writing, if somebody says, well, I'm, you know, a Christian author and I'm writing books, and everybody's going to think, okay, this is going to be a big morality tale like the Hallmark television mm-hmm. series. They're going to thump you on the head with some big, huge theme. But again, what you do in a lot of your books and in all your books is really, you know, tell a real story, but religion is part of that story because it's part of everybody's real life, as you say, the searching aspects of this. And so for me, it's really interesting to read this because it's not religion presented as the main thrust of the book, but it's life with religion, if that makes sense
right.
at all. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I would say that often even atheists are writing about it, though they may not mean to. You know, there's a Graham Greene novel called The End of the Affair, where it begins with one of the characters saying, "I hate you, God, I hate you as though you existed."
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic line, and it kind of brings to mind the fact that most ardent atheists can't stop talking about God. They talk more about God than priests.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, look at Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins. They both ended up becoming kind of professional atheists. And it's fascinating to me because, you know, I don't know no Christians that talk as much about God as Richard Dawkins does.
Yeah. No, that is a fascinating observation. Like, if you're an atheist, you know, why bother talking about it? Just move on. But, yeah, there's that searching and longing that I still think is there.
Right. Yeah. I totally agree.
Mm-hmm. So you follow up Going Down Swinging with a couple other books, Cease to Blush, which has a pretty risque cover to it. I mean, not really. Somebody would say, you know, for those of you religious folks out here, pick up this book. I think they'd look at the cover and go, ooh, okay, that's not Hallmark Channel. And then also One Good Hustle. So tell us a little bit about the development of your writing in these books and how you picked up themes from earlier writings.
Cease to Blush, I mean, in its foundation is it's a story, but it's also kind of an exploration of feminism and what it started out to mean and what it came to mean. You know, in this current climate, it's a very elastic term. And I think that it's really lost the substance of what it started out to be. I mean, it's become almost meaningless, the term. I mean, everything is supposed to be feminism. You know, being a stripper is somehow supposed to be a feminist act. Getting breast implants, you know, Ms. Magazine at one point called it a feminist act. And these things are all, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, the notion of feminism at its core was meant to be, you know, about equal rights and, you know, getting the vote, the emancipation, if you will. So that was what I was playing with that. When I was traveling, I did a drive down the west coast of the U.S., and I wanted to do this for the narrator of the novel, and I met this Pentecostal couple. They invited me to come to their table and have dinner with them. They're from the Deep South. And when I used it for the book, although, you know, it became very, you know, I took it to a very different place. But they were a fascinating couple to me because they just despised the word feminism because of what it meant to them. They felt about feminism the way my mother feels when she hears the word Christian. So, you know, we tend to project meaning onto so many terms because we see it through the lens of a pretty limited experience. And that's more, you know, what I was exploring in that book. And then the book that followed, One Good Hustle, it's actually referring to hustles in the realm of the con, so con artistry.
Mm-hmm.
And that book came about because my father was a con artist.
Are these
Go ahead. I didn't know if I should give you a moment to.
Yeah, actually, no. I think it's a really cool experience. I'm just wondering, as you talk about this, are these books difficult to write for you? Because you're drawing on a lot of past experience, and as well as some experiences you have along the way. I mean, this dinner with the Pentecostal group. Now, actually, I have to stop. And that dinner with the Pentecostals while you're driving down the West Coast, where was that?
That was in Northern California. They had a Volkswagen bus. They had a van that they were driving around, and they were kind of evangelizing, going from town to town.
Wild.
And they had told me about, they also brought in young women from prison who were about to be paroled. They would bring them into their place and use their place as a halfway house.
Mm.
They were an interesting couple.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. You said kind of a deep South couple, and then California, that's a culture clash of
right,
you know, extraordinary proportions.
What I wanted for the book was to hear, I asked them if they spoke in tongues, and they said, oh, yeah, we've been tongue-talking for about 20 years now. But, you know, obviously they weren't going to do it right there at the dinner table, and I'd never heard it. So I went out to a church about an hour out of town here, one of those, you know, mega churches where they have about 4,000 or 5,000 people can fit, and they were having a revival weekend, and I got an eyeful, an earful, all around me, and just tried to describe it while I was sitting there listening.
Yeah, I mean, that must be kind of cool. You see these outside experiences, and you experience them at a different level, and just meeting these people and going to these places. But as you mentioned, too, the One Good Hustle book has these elements of, okay, my dad was a con artist, and I'm writing about this. Is that difficult to write about? Do you feel yourself rethinking some of your past and reevaluating it? Is that, you know, therapeutic? Do you have spiritual experiences while doing this?
Sure, from time to time, because, you know, in a way, trying to write a fictional character, you know, loosely based on my father, then I start to reconsider him and who he was. And though he was, by his own admission, no kind of father, you have to write a three-dimensional human being when you're writing fiction. So, you know, you have to try to search and reinterpret the man that you may have shut down on a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it becomes good for me as a human being. It becomes good for, you know, the one's faith in the divine in that way, in that you just start to try to understand your own love and your own fear, and what the truth there, though deeply buried, might be.
Mm-hmm.
And he, my father, was, speaking of ardent atheists, he was an ardent atheist.
Hmm.
And so I was also using some of the stuff, the people that I experienced when I was in church, when I was in my teens, in the evangelical church. And even though I clashed with them a lot, those people were the only ones who were there to come and take care of me when everything fell apart with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people are complicated, you know?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many facets to an individual where they, you know, you can fight furiously with a human being and still see the facets of love and their desire to do the right thing and to be a good human being. And, you know, it's kind of all there, which I think should be there in us all, just as a matter of our humanity and of our search for faith and to deepen our own faith.
Yeah, we tend to see that as we get older, I think. And I think you're in a unique vantage point that you're writing on some of this stuff that, you know, you're building fictional characters based upon people in your past history. I mean, there must be some interesting viewpoint that you bring to the table that, okay, I write about these things that happened 20, 30 years ago or so. I mean, do you look at them with new eyes? Do you come up with new realizations saying, oh, you know, 20 years ago, that really sucked. But you know what? Now I kind of understand it a little bit differently.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And, you know, perhaps especially with my mother, you know, I think when you're in your teens, you're very confused and you just, you know, Every new frustration just becomes a new normal, and you kind of accept it. Then as you get into your 20s and 30s, you can get into your angry phase, where you think, I didn't deserve that. And this that didn't go so well. I should have been parented better. And then I think you kind of come around to the other side of that again, and realize that people are really, if they knew how to do better, they would. I mean, everybody thinks that they're doing the right thing at the time. That's what they're fighting for, is to do what they believe is the right thing at that moment. And, you know, we're all pretty flawed, and we make mistakes. So, and I think once you get into your 40s, in particular, I think that really hits home.
Yeah. No, and then being a fictional author that is writing these semi-autobiographical pieces, I mean, it puts you in a different light. I mean, from my end, I'm a social scientist. I look back on this stuff and try to analyze it through social science lens, and that's pretty dull, I have to say. What you're doing is pretty cool, I have to say. Let's get into your latest novel, The Crooked Heart of Mercy. And I got a couple questions on this, and some of them tend to be a little bit inside baseball in the publishing industry here. I noticed that, I think it was on Amazon and also your website, there's two different covers for it. One has an airplane, a toy airplane, and some kids' shoes on top of it, and then the other one is more a bluish cover with some splotches and circles and things.
What? Oh, City Lights.
City Lights, okay. Yeah, what's the deal with that? Why two different covers?
Oh, two different publishers.
Oh, really?
In Canada, it's published by Random House, and they really wanted a cover that, you know, more typographic and something that didn't kind of limit to a particular story. And then in the U.S., it's published by William Morrow, HarperCollins, and I think their art department was wanting to play with something that felt a little more like an Ann Tyler novel, something, a cover that almost told a story in itself.
Yeah.
That's why that happened.
I'm always fascinated by book covers. I know the cliche is you can't judge a book by a cover, but a lot of stuff goes into the covers of books, and a lot of authors have conflicts over.
In Canada, we went through dozens.
Yeah.
And ultimately the one that we thought we'd settled on, one of the big booksellers here, they didn't think that the cover we'd settled on lived up to what the novel was, the ambitions of the novel.
Mm.
So they didn't think it seemed big enough.
Mm.
So we went back to the drawing board.
Well, yeah. No, that's. I don't think many people realize how much effort goes into covers and how authors sometimes don't get very much input into it. And then it oftentimes creates conflict with the publisher too, saying, no, that's completely misrepresents what I'm doing. But
I've had both experiences.
So the title of the book, The Crooked Heart of Mercy, the word crooked, it's kind of making a comeback with Donald Trump saying crooked all the time. I can't help thinking back. This is like taking me back to my my childhood days back in the early 70s when Nixon was using crooked all the time.
All right. I'm not a crook.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, we got over that word, and now crooked is back in there in our lexicon. So your book might be peaking right here at the right time with that word. what goes into the title of this, and explain, you know, how you're coming, The Crooked Heart of Mercy. Where does crooked come in and where does mercy come in?
Well, the crooked heart of mercy, that first, the word crooked actually came from an Auden poem. And I can read you a bit of it, the stanzas that it came from. The poem is called As I Walked Out One Evening. Oh, look in the mirror. Oh, look in your distress. Life remains a blessing, although you cannot bless. Oh, stand in the window as the tears scald and start. You shall love your crooked neighbor with your crooked heart. So that's where that part comes from. And then the mercy comes from, people tend to think of mercy as, you know, Lord have mercy, meaning don't hurt me, don't crush me. But mercy actually comes from a Greek word, ilios. And the ancient Greeks used to use olive oil as part of medicinal healing practice. So there's this kind of tactile or visceral connotation. And in Hebrew, it comes from a word meaning steadfast love. And so when you look at it all together, mercy is much more about love and healing and, immerse me in this healing love would come from, the Lord have mercy. So,
give us a little bit of the plot line. Give us a little bit of the plot line here. I don't want to, spoil it. No spoilers, but we want people to go out and get the book themselves and read it. It's a really nice read. And again, for somebody who doesn't read fiction much, it was pleasant reading. Give us an idea of the plot line, who the characters are and how you're exploring this theme of mercy. And you have another theme in there that you mentioned as well, is the theme of guilt. Tell us about all of this.
Okay. Well, there are three main characters. The book is told in two voices. So there's Ben, who has a hole in his head. And we began with him in a psychiatric ward of a general hospital. And he's not quite sure how he got this head wound. And Maggie, his wife, who has recently left him, and they have lost their child. And Maggie's brother, Francis, who's an alcoholic priest with very little interest in celibacy, and he's just had this, he's been arrested for his third driving while impaired charge. And he was videotaped while he was in the holding cell, and the video went viral. So he ends up at Maggie's place while she's trying to deal with the fact that her husband has landed in a psych ward. So that's the jumping off point.
Mm-hmm. Let me stop you right there. Where did this idea come from? Because your earlier books, you're picking up things from your past history. As you say, they're kind of quasi-autobiographical or fictional, fictionalized autobiography kind of things. Is this book, are you developing new themes? Are new characters coming about? Or are you still drawing a lot on your past experiences?
Well, long before I was born, my father and his first wife had a little boy, and when they weren't paying attention, he was 2 years old, and he climbed up on the windowsill, and he fell out the window and died that way. And I was always really haunted by this story. one, that I would have had a brother, and had he lived, and two, my God, what does somebody do with that kind of guilt and horror that, you know, one moment of their life they looked in a direction other than their child, and it was fatal. So there was that, and it was also interweaving with my husband. Tim was in the seminary when we were first dating, and I used to go and visit him there. I used to call them the priesty boys. And so I got to know a lot of these young seminarians and would-be priests, and we used to sit up on the rooftop patio and, you know, drinking cocktails and bantering, and they were really interesting young men, and they felt they had a vocation, but they were really unsure if they could put their appetites aside. So a lot of their fear and grace and general smartassery kind of crystallized in Maggie's brother Francis. And then Ben, who's in the hospital, he came about after I read a story about this 17-year-old kid in Florida who ate too many psychedelic mushrooms. He hung out with his friends one weekend. His parents were away. They took a whole bunch of mushrooms and had a great time, apparently laughed a lot. Then his friends left and went home, and he fell asleep on the couch and believed he had woken up, but he was trapped in a nightmare, and he was having hallucinations and was sure that he was still asleep, and was the reason of a losing powers of a 17-year-old kid. He went to his parents' closet and got out a .22 rifle and put the muzzle to his head and shot himself trying to wake up, and realized when blood was everywhere that this was no dream. He really had shot himself, and of course, you know, ended up in the hospital in the psych ward and spent the next little while trying to convince them that he had not tried to kill himself. He was trying to wake up. So these stories all kind of interwove and became this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you are drawing on some of your past, and you're just starting to draw, you know, characters from other parts of the news that you read and things, which, again, you've been doing too with the Pentecostal family that you mentioned before.
Right.
So really interesting how you put all these things together. And how, in exploring the themes, and without, again, giving the, you know, the entire plot away, how do you write this book to explore the themes of mercy and of guilt? Are you doing that consciously? Do you start off with the idea, okay, I want to take this Greek idea of mercy, of aleos, and explore that? Or do you just write the story and say, as I'm writing the story, the characters are developing, and I can see where mercy in these characters develops?
It's more the latter. Yeah, I'm much more concerned with story and really fleshing out people and having them be fully realized human beings. I'm not crazy about, I've never started out with a theme in mind and gone from there.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, that's fascinating to me because, again, it's so antithetical to social science research where we have these hypotheses and we develop this. It's fascinating, and I get the sense of it in your writing that there's these people, and they start out and you say, I don't know what's going to happen to them. I'm just going to write. And then it just happens, you know, 200 pages later, you're there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think, too, the more fleshed out these people become, then the more you can get a, you know, once you really see how a person responds under pressure, that's, you know, I think how one comes to know the character of another person. It's not, you know, what they wear or the color of lipstick they've got on, etc. It's more the way they behave under pressure. So, you know, in a novel, it becomes really what you're discovering.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? I mean, I'm just fascinated by the whole process of this. Do you start by saying, okay, this is where I want the person to end up? Or do you put them in a situation saying, okay, now we're in a sanitarium, we're in a psych ward, and I wonder what this person is going to do? And you just kind of role play that through your mind. How do you write this?
You know, it stewed, these people stewed in my head for the longest time. I went and visited a priest who is actually in rehab. So I had this idea of a priest with a drinking problem. There was a notorious video that went around of a priest in a drunk tank for a while. That was really fascinating to me. And least of all because a person can be really flawed like that, be a mess like Francis is, you know, and perhaps like the priest that I knew was, and yet really capable of doing the most beautiful things in their church and for their parishioners, and be completely adored because they are one person in the community who's willing to do whatever it takes to help and create a community. And so you can, you know, more than one thing can be true at once. You can be this really screwed up person who's capable of such grace. And so I wanted that. I wanted to make a character like that, who is Francis, who's the religious name he took was Father Luke. So he's, you know, he's kind of, in a way, both these two different people and yet the same person in that. So he was stewing in my head. This little boy was stewing in my head. And the notion of ending up in a psych ward with everybody convinced that you were trying to kill yourself when what you wanted was something, was the antithesis of that, was to be alive and awake and present. So I think, you know, once you sort of find the person, then you just keep writing them and writing them until it's a bit of a fiction writer's cliche, but it starts to feel like they are moving and walking and talking on their own.
Yeah, I've never quite experienced that, and I think it must be really interesting to be a writer in your genre to do that, because it just seems so fun and so imaginative.
Well, you can lose hours, you know,
yeah,
wandering around in the playhouse in your skull, you know, with these people that at first just begin as sock puppets, and then all of a sudden they're animated.
Yeah. How long does it take to write one of these books? And you know, do you bounce these ideas off of other people like Tim? And you know, do you talk to him about, hey, I'm writing about some of these, this Father Luke guy, and remember when you were in the seminary, this was kind of like so-and-so. I mean, that must be really interesting.
Tim is great for to bounce ideas off, because he was a theater director and an actor. Well, he is presently an actor, but he had his own theater company in New York, and so he's really great about having conversations about an active plot, you know, and making active choices, because he's used to trying to instill that as a director. So it's great to have a husband who's so interested and so capable, you know, as kind of a dramaturge. And he was a little leery at first when I was saying that I wanted to, write something that involved characters that mirrored some of the people that we spent time with at the seminary. But, you know, I think he eventually trusts my impulses, that it, you know, I never have the desire to, you know, create a villainous character or a foil, someone who's, you know, a character who's just flat and has no redeeming qualities, because I'm just of the mind that everybody, even some of the most awful people we've known, if you stop and talk and listen, they do have redeeming qualities. They do have, you know, hopes and desires and all this.
It really does come through.
I got off track.
Yeah. No, this is great off track. I want to reflect on your writing is that, you were talking about this earlier, how, these persons can be just wonderful in their parish, but still struggling with their own demons. And I think that's such a valuable lesson that the fiction writing can actually bring this stuff home to people. Because again, you see in the news all the time, pastor so-and-so has this crisis and immediately the congregation just tosses them overboard or without realizing that, we're all flawed people in one way or the other. And we have these very complex lives that we live. And I think that's really cool how fiction can explore that much better than in many other ways of writing or communicating it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it must be, particularly with some of the, some of the scandals the major scandal that has gone on in the Catholic Church with kids and with, it must be very difficult to be a priest out in the world right now and wearing a collar and not having just the average person on the street assume that you are a pedophile. And I think it must happen a lot. Or in people who are in Islam look at an imam and assume he's somehow leading a terrorist group, and certainly, there must be the same similar things with pastors, and although, pastors don't usually wear identifiable garb. But still, the assumptions that people make.
Yeah. No, that's... Our pastor has that experience that, he'll be skiing somewhere and sitting on a chairlift, and the chairlift stops and somebody will ask him and say, "Hey, what are you doing?" He says, "I'm a pastor." It immediately changes everything, doesn't it?
You're no longer talking like themselves.
Yeah, you're no longer a human being or something. You're mm-hmm. Superman and in a moral cloak or something like that. But
And how does anybody live up to that?
Yeah. No, it becomes issuing. And fiction, as you say, is a great way of exploring that, because you're able to sculpt the characters and to move them in directions that you think tell a really good morality tale that is going mm-hmm. on there. Let me go ahead and finish off with one final question that we often ask our guests here on Research on Religion, and that is how this whole process has affected you over your life. You're looking back now and you're going back to the teenage years, from filling the milk coolers to dealing with your mom and all of that kind of stuff. You do the writing. Was there any thing looking backwards you say, you know what, I really am surprised at how I changed or how I view the world differently now because of this whole process of fiction writing, of poetry, and of writing essays?
I think a lot, the main thing that probably comes out of it, and I don't know, and it may happen, for everybody as you age, but maybe particularly as a writer, as a fiction writer, the sympathy that I have now and the sympathy that I have gained as time has passed and through writing people that at first glance they've been really unsavory human beings, but pushing yourself in a position where you've got to be inside them and fight for them in a way, argue their point, even if you don't agree with it, but try to see what their point is. And I think through that I've gained a lot more sympathy than I had, certainly as a, as a 20-year-old, when I was convinced that I knew everything, and I saw things far more in black and white. People, I don't know why there has been a cultural rejection of the word sympathy. People want to use the word empathy now instead. But, empathy really means that you feel what that person is feeling. And you know, I think I don't always feel what that person is feeling, but I certainly feel for them, and do everything I can to see the human being in a way that I probably didn't when I was a youngin'. And I think that a lot of that has to do with, you know, what we were talking about with mercy early on. You know, just the feeling that you try to do your best to come from a place of love and a place of understanding.
Well, that is a great lesson that we all can learn and continually learn as I get older too. I experience many of the same feelings or experiences of sympathy that you have as well, and a lot of it can be done through our own writing and also through reading your book, The Crooked Heart of Mercy, and some of your other things. My guest today has been Billy Livingston. Billy, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.